This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of November, and this week the impeachment process moved out into public, with current and former State Department officials testifying about the ways they saw President Trump pressure Ukraine to announce an investigation into the Bidens. The first day of hearings averaged 13 million viewers, which is about the same as for Robert Mueller's testimony to Congress a few months back. And on Friday, we know at least one of the viewers was President Trump, as he was tweeting his real-time complaints about fired Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch as she testified. It's a quick hearing schedule. Hearings are set for this week and next, and the House will likely have voted on impeachment by Christmas. In a moment, we'll talk about whether we've learned anything from the hearings and whether there's any sign they've changed the dynamic, where support for the impeachment inquiry roughly tracks general disapproval of the president. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review on the right, and on the left is Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hello, Josh.
So there's been other news this week, and it includes the addition of a new candidate to the Democratic primary field. No, not Mike Bloomberg. He's still considering his options, though he says he's going to spend $100 million on anti-Trump ads in any case. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is running for president. As with the Bloomberg balloon, his entry reflects an unease with the current frontrunners among certain elements of the Democratic Party establishment, that Joe Biden is too old and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren too left-wing to beat Trump. Patrick was only the second African-American ever elected governor of a U.S. state. He was a popular two-term governor of Massachusetts, and he's close with Barack Obama. But after his governorship, he became a managing director at Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's old firm, and he's faced skepticism from the left. Liz, it seems to me Patrick's main pitch isn't to the left anyway. The idea is he's supposed to be a moderate candidate who can run as a successor to Obama and be a more credible pick for black voters and maybe for moderate white voters against Joe Biden than some of the other non-Biden moderates in this field have been.
Yeah, it's difficult to see what lane he's trying to occupy because every lane in the race is occupied a couple times over at this point. It's especially difficult to see what he adds beyond, say, Cory Booker. And I think that's why a lot of the response to Patrick entering the race has just been plain exasperation.
Yeah, Michael, it seems to me the number one obstacle to Deval Patrick becoming president or becoming the Democratic nominee is who even knows who Deval Patrick is outside Massachusetts.
Right. He was not a superstar governor that made headlines across the nation. It's funny because this is a person who's known well inside elite Democrat circles, and it's only in those circles that there is a lot of dissatisfaction with the field. I mean, the polling among Democrats is that they are satisfied with the candidates that they have on hand. So it's hard to imagine a great rationale for this unless you just think that Joe Biden has to be removed from the race and someone has to attract African-American voters to do it. And you think Deval can do this. I'm not sure that he can.
Yeah, Liz, that's the crazy thing to me about this. It's this disconnect between party elites that are very concerned about this field and a party base that says in polling it's actually more satisfied with this candidate field than it has been in past races. Is that's not just a disconnect about how far left the candidate should be. It's not just, you know, liberal voters who are satisfied because they really like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. You have a lot of people who really like Joe Biden, and it feels to me that a lot of people just can't come to terms with Joe Biden, in fact, being a strong candidate for president.
Well, Biden isn't he's been neck and neck with Warren in some of the early primary states. In some states, she's even overtaken him. I get the sense that the party elites don't especially love her and wouldn't be thrilled with a Warren administration. And so they think that Biden is vulnerable in the primary.
Liz, what have you been watching this week?
So this week, the Southern Poverty Law Center, in conjunction with Katie McHugh, a former Breitbart employee who has moved away from the alt-right, released a trove of emails belonging to Stephen Miller, close advisor of Donald Trump. I think everyone probably knew that Stephen Miller was behind Trump's immigration policy, that he has been the guiding hand of the more xenophobic side of the Trump administration. But these emails drive home the fact that he is not only what some have called and what the Southern Poverty Law Center called a white nationalist, but is definitely enmeshed in the intellectual milieu of the alt-right. What struck me about Miller's emails, I grew up in the South. I'm pretty accustomed to racism in conversation and in political discourse, is that his is not the ordinary racism of the ordinary American. It's not strewn with slurs or swear words. It isn't just frustration. It's an entire mindset. It's a whole political framework with an opinion of race that is deeply inflammatory and divisive woven in. I think that Miller is something different than the average American racist. And I think that what he's bringing to the table politically is different than racism we've seen in American politics before, and possibly a lot more dangerous. The arguments that Stephen Miller is using come from a more developed ideology, and they seem to imply that there is a difference, maybe an inherent or genetic difference between people from Western Europe, white people, white people in the West, and people who don't come from those parts of the world, and that people who don't come from those parts of the world, people who come from Africa, the Global South, Southeast Asia, etc., are criminal, are less intelligent, are reproducing much more rapidly than white Westerners, and therefore will destroy any country that they come to. This is the point of The Camp of the Saints, which is a novel that Miller recommended Katie read. That's Katie as in Katie McHugh, the Breitbart employee who later moved away from the alt-right.
So, Michael, why is Miller still in the administration, and why aren't Republicans bothered, or at least not, why aren't Republicans openly complaining about his continued employment in the administration?
Those are two different questions. I mean, the first reason he's in there is because he's been very active on the immigration question for years, working with people like Senator Jeff Sessions and others who were trying to pioneer restrictionist legislation and measures for a future presidency. Miller does have some subject expertise on the legal aspects of immigration, how the system works. As I'm sure many listeners know, our current legal immigration system is extremely complex. There are many different factors in it that are kind of legacies over the last 50 or 60 years. So that's why he's there. He's also able to channel that expertise into populist rhetoric that the president really likes deploying. I don't know why Republicans aren't demanding his resignation. It is the sort of thing where I think 5 years ago they would have if this kind of person was in the administration, in a Republican administration. I think there's partly fatigue over Trump's scandals. They are, bored and listless from what we see in the impeachment stuff. And this is just one more thing added on top of it, one more scandal. And I think it's all just a confusing melange for them at this point.
Well, and also there's, so central in Republican politics right now is who is able to be the most supportive of Donald Trump. And to that point, Michael, you wrote this week about former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley and her new book, sort of positioning herself simultaneously as a strong supporter and an internal critic of the president. What did you make of what she has to say about herself?
So Haley's been on this kind of book tour and reminding everyone in Washington and the world that she exists after she left her post as ambassador to the UN. She gave a speech to the American Enterprise Institute's annual dinner 2 weeks ago. She's been doing the rounds of media, and she's been hammering this one point in her book, the one, I guess, juicy news detail, which was that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and others in the administration approached her to, quote, save the country from the president. And she rebuffed them. And in this book, she makes an argument that President Trump is duly elected, that the cabinet and other people in the executive branch serve at the pleasure of the president, and that they shouldn't be freelancing in this way. I thought it was interesting. I don't particularly find Nikki Haley a compelling figure. Many Republicans and conservatives do think that she could be a future president. I think she thinks she could be a future president. But I did actually appreciate her making this point. I do think for the good of the institution of the presidency beyond Trump, we can't have this idea that there is some kind of, American foreign policy that is separated from the president, and that cabinet officials or bureaucrats are empowered to undermine the president so directly.
Right. And Liz, what do you make of this sort of unusual positioning that Nikki Haley has managed to achieve for herself? I mean, the sort of, you know, saying to the president, well, I'll criticize you to your face, that doesn't seem to work for most people in his administration. A lot of people, I think, quite reasonably think they'd get fired if they did that. Nikki Haley has managed to pull this off in an unusual way.
Right. I mean, I think it bespeaks a certain tact on her part. Once you meet Trump, you probably have a sense of how to deal with him. And she has maybe achieved that interpersonal rapport that allows her to suggest respectfully something, you know, in the form of criticism. But we know that one thing that matters to Trump almost more than anything else is press. He cares a lot about his press. He cares about his ratings, his numbers, his crowds. He cares about what the talk shows are saying about him, and he watches them fastidiously and tweets about it. So I think as long as his people are willing to defend him in the press, he might be capable of accepting a little bit of in-person criticism as long as it's offered in a sort of deferential way. I don't know, you know, it sort of in concurrence with Michael, if that actually makes her the compelling political figure she thinks it does. But, I mean, it certainly makes her a sort of interesting courtier.
There's been all this press on and off over the last few months about the idea that, that Trump might remove Mike Pence from the ticket when seeking re-election, put Nikki Haley on it. And it's clearly irritated a lot of people around Mike Pence who think that people around Haley have been encouraging that conversation. It also sort of it fits the president's preference for drama and for insecurity among his underlings, that he would at least want people to think that he was thinking about choosing one of two different apprentices who could be his running mate. Michael, do you put any stock in the idea that there's actually a chance that she's going to get put on the ticket? And is this book part of a strategy to position herself for that?
I think there is a chance that she gets put on the ticket. Donald Trump has shown a certain amount of loyalty and respect to Mike Pence at times. I mean, the reporting about that Tim Alberta did about the Access Hollywood tape shows Trump openly worrying what Mike Pence and his wife will think of him after this, and appreciating their loyalty, especially when they came around him. However, at the same time, you're right, he loves drama, and I think he's also open to the idea that he no longer needs to win the trust of evangelical voters, that they are already a part of his coalition. In fact, the most solid part of his coalition of Republican voters, but that he has a lot of work to do in stanching the losses among upwardly mobile suburban women who have been defecting to the Democratic Party in 2018 and in every poll since. And he may think that Haley can help him do that. So I think there is a chance he will at least make an overture to Nikki Haley to come onto the ticket. I don't think she would want to join it.
Really?
She's positioning herself as a good soldier and as loyal opposition to Trump now, and is waiting for a post-Trump party to open up for her.
Now, this theme about the idea that the president makes policy and his underlings shouldn't undermine him simply because they disagree with the policy decisions that he's making, this has been a key theme in the defense of the president through this impeachment process. And the argument that we saw about a lot of the testimony that we saw on Wednesday from George Kent and Bill Taylor was basically that the president had a policy dispute with Bill Taylor, who is our acting ambassador to Ukraine. And basically, the president wanted to make a Ukraine policy that officials in the foreign policy establishment disagreed with, that frankly that a lot of, you know, Republican and Democratic elected officials disagree with. But he's the president and he gets to make this policy, and you know, it's not the job of the acting ambassador to Ukraine to decide what our policy toward Ukraine should be. And I'm sympathetic to this argument in the abstract. The problem I see, and I want your thought on this, Michael, is that, again, I go back to, he was having Rudy Giuliani make this policy, and you have Rudy Giuliani out there publicly insisting that the actions that he took were solely in his capacity representing Donald Trump in his personal capacity as his attorney. And so, you know, when you say that the president gets to make foreign policy, I don't think that means the president gets to tell a foreign leader, go work with my personal attorney on the demands my personal attorney have, which my personal attorney says are for my personal capacity, not for the country. This seems like the sort of thing that it's perfectly appropriate for career staffers, for diplomats to stand up and say, this is not an exercise of the presidential power. This is a hijacking of the presidential power for a personal purpose.
So I'm going to split the difference there a little bit. One, it's just inappropriate to send Rudy Giuliani, you know, anywhere at this point other than home. But it is not wrong for the president to use a trusted advisor as a cutout or as an extra diplomatic channel when making policy. This has been done over and over and over again in United States history. That is not controversial to me. It is not. The State Department serves the president. I think the hearings have been muddied by the suggestion that what we saw in the hearings is, instead of focusing on what I think is the prime question, which is, was Donald Trump's request of the Ukrainian president in Donald Trump's personal political interest only? I think that Taylor and others did demonstrate that it was. But they tried to introduce these almost aggravating factors, as in one aggravating factor, the president is changing policy in Ukraine and doesn't seem to understand, as Taylor suggested, that Ukraine is a front line in our conflict with Russia. That's a policy disagreement that I don't think has a place in an impeachment hearing. And secondly, it doesn't have any place in an impeachment hearing that the president has ruffled the feathers of longtime State Department employees. That is also a normal part of the presidency. And I think some of those details may excite Democrats. They may actually feel them to be aggravating factors, to be part of this norm-smashing presidency. I think they distract from the main point that could be the basis for legitimate impeachment and removal. The president does get to set his own policy. He does get to annoy his own State Department officials. He does get to run around them. But the question for impeachment should be, does he get to do it for this request of an investigation of Joe and Hunter Biden? Really, it wasn't even a request for an investigation. It was really, I think Taylor did demonstrate it was a request for an announcement of an investigation, which to me is evidence that it was purely for the politics, that, you know, there's no way you can say this was a genuine interest in corruption.
But so, I mean, Liz, I think to Michael's point, I think the choice by Nancy Pelosi to pursue this relatively narrow path around impeachment specific to Ukraine is because, I mean, obviously people will get upset about all sorts of things, but the it seems to me the core issue, which they look likely to impeach him over, is the thing that Michael is identifying there as the wrongdoing, which is the use of the Ukraine policy for a purely personal purpose.
Right. And I mean, that's something that the Democrats have been trying to nail Trump on for a long time because he's so obviously doing it. Using the presidency to make money for himself and for his various business ventures and for his family's various business ventures is something that he's been doing pretty much in the open. It's just been difficult to pin down. This is a place where it appears they have been able to pin down at least an attempt to try to use our policy on Ukraine in order to dig up dirt on who he thought was going to be his most likely opponent in the next presidential race. If they can pin that down, and I think they've done a pretty good job of it, then I think that there is something to impeach on. And it does sort of bolster the argument that Pelosi chose to go with in the end, which was to pursue a more direct, less expansive impeachment process.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about another area of foreign policy where the president has been ruffling a lot of feathers in Washington, which is to say policy toward Turkey. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. On Wednesday, President Trump hosted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan at the White House, despite threatening Turkey with sanctions just weeks earlier over its invasion of northern Syria. And the meeting was friendly. Trump said he was a big fan of Erdogan's, and he tried to keep their joint press conference nice, too.
Thank you very much. Would you like to pick somebody? A friendly person from Turkey, please. Friendly. Only friendly reporters. We like to see. There aren't too many of them around.
To talk about Wednesday's meeting and our broader relationship with Turkey, we're joined now by Merve Teherlu. Merve is Turkey Program Coordinator at the Project on Middle East Democracy. Hello, Merve.
Hi.
So what was remarkable to me about that exchange was the questioner indeed produced a question that was friendly to Turkey, asking why the U.S. supports Kurdish terrorists. And President Trump then looked irritated, asking whether the reporter works for Turkey with a question like that. What is the state of press freedom in Turkey right now?
I mean, this was actually a pretty telling moment of that, because Hilal Kaplan, the person that President Erdogan actually called on, it's a very valid question to ask whether she's an actual journalist, because she writes for this major Erdogan mouthpiece in Turkey, a newspaper that does more than disinformation, also just trolling in general. And she heads a lot of these trolling activities on behalf of Erdogan's government in Turkey, which is coming amidst this time where, you know, as we all know at this point, Turkey is the world's biggest jailer of journalists. Beyond that, Erdogan controls nearly 90% to 95% of the media outlets that do exist. And on top of that, there's still a very large crackdown where journalists are continuously arrested over and over again. So the fact that we're looking at a Turkey with very little space for journalists to actually, independent journalists to continue with their unbiased, objective, independent coverage of anything. We have totally Erdogan controlling the narrative on many issues, including foreign policy issues, including the U.S. And Hilal Kaplan actually plays a major role in that. So it was pretty revealing for all the Turkey watchers to see him call out on her, and then President Trump actually come around and say, are you sure you don't work for the Turkish government? It was an ironic moment for all of us.
So we've been seeing this increased turn toward authoritarianism under President Erdogan in Turkey, and we've also been seeing increased tension or distance in the relationship, the longstanding alliance between the United States and Turkey. Are those related matters? Because it seems to me, you know, a lot of the prior Turkish governments that we had a better alignment with were military governments. It was not necessarily based on, you know, on American principles of freedom and democracy, at least on an American system. So basically, is a move toward, you know, a more free and open system in Turkey, is that something that necessarily serves the U.S.-Turkish alliance? Or are these sorts of two separate problems that require separate solutions?
Well, I think they're deeply, deeply intertwined, actually, these issues of what Erdogan's been doing in Turkey. I mean, look, you made a really right point previously, that Turkish governments have not been as democratic as we would like them to be. And the U.S. maintained a strong alliance with Turkey for many decades, despite all of the military coups and repressive governments that Turkey has seen. But at the same time, I think it's very important to see that Erdogan is a very different leader. First of all, he's been ruling Turkey for 17 years. No person has ruled Turkey for that long before. And second, the transformation he's trying to do inside Turkey is really massive and historical. I mean, with all of its flaws, and we can say it was a completely, I mean, imperfect democracy. It had like four or five coups every 10 years. We can't see that as a normal democracy in Turkey. But at the same time, the Turkish Republic, as we know it, since the 1920s, has always seen itself as part of this, you know, Western world, as part of the transatlantic alliance, and it has strived to be part of that world. And that is why it took all of its democratizing steps that it did. So despite all of the problems with the previous Turkish governments, we always had a Turkey trying to uphold certain democratic values in order to project itself as part of the transatlantic alliance. With Erdogan, we're seeing a very different attitude, an ideological foreign policy that is geared towards moving Turkey away from the transatlantic alliance. Erdogan presents this as wanting to make Turkey more independent, quote unquote, in the international stage, but instead he's just making Turkey more and more reliant on Russia. And I think all of these things both are parallel the domestic crackdowns that we're seeing, because Erdogan's consolidation of power inside Turkey through the last 17 years has both aided him in shaping a new foreign policy for the Turkish Republic, but also has helped him consolidate his power as well. So they're deeply entwined in that they both serve this purpose and in aiding his consolidation of power at home, but also helping shape public opinion in a way that now we're seeing, you know, overwhelming majority of Turkish public opinion is, you know, very against the United States, sees the U.S. as the number one threat, and they see Russia as a country that Turkey should be building a better relationship with. So, of course, they're very much intertwined.
Michael, can you make sense of the president's posture toward Turkey? Because obviously he's not taking an idealistic posture that some people in Congress might like him to. But it doesn't seem to me like he's taking a realist posture either. He has not effectively used U.S. tools to put pressure on Turkey to align with our interests in the region. I mean, most notably with giving Erdogan the green light effectively to go ahead and invade northern Syria, and then turning around a few days and yelling at Erdogan and sending him this strange letter that Erdogan just sent right back. It doesn't seem to me like there's a coherent, defensible story about the way this administration has approached Turkey.
There isn't a good explanation for Trump's behavior here. I mean, I will say this, though. The decision that the Obama administration made to work with the Kurds in northern Syria was an obvious source of strain and tension with Turkey. There was no good way to resolve this. There was no way Turkey would stand for the United States setting up a kind of, Kurdish, semi-statelet on the Turkish border. And so there, something did had to give in that. The way that the Trump administration went about doing it was particularly blunderbuss and destructive. But, you know, there's no way to remove Turkey from NATO. There's no, like, expulsion process that's set up for the Western democracies to do something like that. And it would be very disruptive to do so. So I think we're stuck with this kind of ambiguous and difficult relationship for a long time. Trump's not managing it very intelligently. But I think any president was going to have trouble managing our relationship with the Kurds and this relationship with Turkey that's ongoing.
And so sort of given that inherent difficulty, Liz, I think that was one of the defenses of the president's choice to have the Turkish president at the White House this week, that, you know, you can be very displeased with what he has done both in Turkey and in our relations with Turkey, but we're in this relationship, like it or not. Is that a good enough reason to host him at the White House and have this sort of fanfare with him?
No, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of rhyme and reason in anything Trump does. And I think this just adds another layer to what has been a very incoherent and chaotic foreign policy that's introduced a lot of chaos in the world. And then that includes his activities with regard to Saudi Arabia. It includes his actions in regard to Turkey. And I think it's created a far more destabilized world than we had before.
Merve, in this context, and in the context of this increasing tension with Turkey and with the action to move into Syria, you had a vote in the House of Representatives, an overwhelming vote, to recognize the Turkish genocide of Armenians approximately 100 years ago, which has been a third rail in U.S.-Turkish relations, and it is basically seen as a brushback pitch to Turkey and the Turkish government that the Congress would take this step to make this recognition. But that resolution has not been brought up in the Senate. And Lindsey Graham, who has in general been a severe critic of President Erdogan, blocked that from coming up in the Senate. Is there a good reason not to make that recognition? I mean, this genocide happened, and the U.S. has basically sort of tried to sidestep that for decades out of a desire to maintain positive relations with the Turkish government. Was it time to basically to stand up and say, no, this happened, and we condemn it?
I mean, this comes at a problematic time, of course, because there are so many bilateral issues with Turkey, and there are very legitimate grievances coming from the U.S. based on Turkey's foreign policy decisions, including the S-400 purchase from Russia and the military incursion into Syria. I mean, this genocide bill, as you mentioned, the U.S. has been sidestepping this for decades. The Armenians have been pushing for the U.S. Congress to recognize this for decades. And for all intents and purposes, if the point is to give a message to Turkey and to Armenians and to the victims of this genocide about it by recognizing it, the U.S. should have done this decades ago. The fact that they're doing it now is sending an important message to Turkey, but is it sending the right message? I mean, one of the most important thing about this bill is that it is highly symbolic. And so the Armenians every year push to have this recognition happen on the anniversary of the genocide, which is in April. Instead, now the House recognized the genocide this time around on Turkey's Republic Day. So it was a very symbolic punishment towards Turkey, the fact that it came on the anniversary of Turkey's Republic Day, but it didn't on the actual anniversary of the genocide, which is what the Armenians, I think, would have preferred to see. But in any case, recognizing it now does not actually address any of the problems that the U.S. has, that U.S. is having with Turkey right now. It doesn't actually address what Turkey is doing in Syria or any of the highly complex problems that are surrounding that, or Turkey's turn towards Russia, none of its foreign policies right now. And more importantly, perhaps, it doesn't actually address or do anything to help prevent current atrocities that are happening against minorities inside Turkey today. I think, you know, it might be more effective for the U.S. Congress to take up those issues and try to put in new measures to protect religious and ethnic minorities right now in Turkey who are going through terrible crackdowns and human rights abuses.
Liz, it's interesting. The one Democrat in the House who voted against this resolution was Ilhan Omar, and her statement explaining why basically said that, you know, that she thought these sorts of things should be recognized on the basis of, you know, of the atrocities that happened and not for political purposes, that it shouldn't be selective for based on what's politically convenient. Now, of course, the odd thing about making that claim is that, of course, the failure to recognize this genocide has been done for political purposes for decades. So it seems that is the if you're going to object to this, that it's just, you know, that it's just real politic. It seems to make more sense to object to not having passed it than to having passed it. But I mean, obviously, that was, you know, she was the one who took that position. You had all the other Democrats and nearly all the Republicans lining up on the side of voting for this resolution.
Yeah, it's a disappointing vote from Ilhan Omar, whose views I generally really like, and whose politics I generally really, really appreciate. I think she's an important voice. I think she's been a fantastic figure in the Trump administration because she is so bold and willing to break, even with Democrats. And I look forward to the future that her career will bring. But at the same time, I disagree with this vote. I think that she was probably under some pressure from constituents and was trying to kind of thread the needle on you know, doing the right thing, but also not going along with what, you know, some might perceive as a politically convenient charade. Ultimately, I think she called it wrong, but I still appreciate her as a figure.
Michael, what do you make of Lindsey Graham blocking this from coming up in the Senate?
It's a surprising move from Lindsey for precisely the reason you said, because he's been such a harsh critic of the Turkish regime. He, you know, he generally favors these kinds of symbolic, moralistic condemnations of bad actors on the world scene. So I am surprised by that, although it is, I think, part of a more general temporizing on Senator Graham's part because of the imperative for Republicans to stay close to Donald Trump and to stay on his good side. So he may have calculated that this is an issue where he is comfortable doing the president a kind of favor, and that's the calculation he made. I personally am not, terribly invested in the idea of Congress and the Senate making these kinds of symbolic votes, not because, there's something wrong in themselves. It's just, these matters are for, historians, for civil society, for academics, and for the public to bring pressure. And I'm not sure that, Congress, making priorities among different victims of genocide is a great game for the institutions of the United States to be in. But so be it.
Finally, Merve, I want to ask you about some reporting on a speech that John Bolton gave, a private speech by the former National Security Advisor, insinuating that the president's sometimes puzzling policy toward Turkey has been made with an eye toward his family's business interests in Turkey. What do you make of that accusation?
This, I think, begs the bigger question of why is President Trump so appeasing towards Erdogan and so close with Erdogan, has such a friendly relationship with him. Look, the people around, people who have been driving this bilateral relationship under the Trump administration have been very few people close to Erdogan, his family, including mainly, I would say, his son-in-law plays a major role in this. And so has been Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And we have figures like this and previous figures in the Trump administration, like Michael Flynn, who have had very close relationships with key people around Erdogan. And it's really these people who have not just a government-to-government relationship right now with each other, but have also had these business ties with one another, and which is why Erdogan has been so closely aligned with the Trump campaign since, the summer of 2016, really. And so how these interests are actually driving that, we can't really know, but we do know that there are deep business interests between the Trump family and the Erdogan family. And more importantly, the Trump family and the Erdogan regime itself. These are the people who are reaching out to people like Lindsey Graham. These are the people who are effectively arranging all of the PR stints that happens whenever Erdogan visits the U.S. And these are the people who, help accommodate the Trump family when they visit Turkey. The Trump Towers in Istanbul is one of these bigger assets that we can talk about in more detail, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. And I think it's important to keep questioning how Trump's business ties to Erdogan has been affecting the way he sees Erdogan as a leader and as a partner of the U.S.
Merve Teherlu is Turkey Program Coordinator at the Project on Middle East Democracy. Merve, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review. We will be back to talk about Jeffrey Epstein. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. This week, Paul Gosar, a right-wing congressman from Arizona, had a little fun with acrostics on Twitter, putting out a series of tweets, the first letter of each tweet spelling out, "Epstein didn't kill himself." This is a conspiracy theory with something for everyone. Jeffrey Epstein had links to so many members of the elite, including Donald Trump and Bill Clinton. You can take that claim and use it to bolster any argument about our corrupt overlords you want. Now, I want to be clear about something. Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. That's what the Medical Examiner report says, and it makes perfect sense. Epstein lived a life of luxury and perversion among America's elite that persisted for decades, and he beat the rap once. But then he was in prison. He was disgraced. He was clearly going to spend the rest of his life behind bars. And it is unsurprising that he would have killed himself. And it's unsurprising that the Bureau of Prisons was so incompetent as to allow it to happen. And Epstein's own estate has reasons to fan the conspiracy flames about his death. As my New York Magazine colleague Matt Steeb notes, a finding of suicide will make it easier for victims to sue the estate and win. The suicide can be taken as a sign of Epstein's guilty conscience. And if Epstein had life insurance, which seems likely given his wealth, a finding of suicide could mean that insurance won't pay out. So take his family's alternative medical report saying he was strangled with a hefty dose of salt. But Michael, I thought you wrote an interesting piece this week about why people say Epstein didn't kill himself, even when they agree with the analysis I just provided and they know that really he did kill himself.
Yeah, I mean, this has gone. So this started being a meme in October, and then it bubbled up, I think, for a few reasons. One, there was a viral Fox News appearance where a dog trainer kind of snuck in at the end of a segment on Waters World, just saying Epstein didn't kill himself at the end of a segment that was on trained dogs that found al-Baghdadi during the raid. But then you also had the Project Veritas leaked video of Amy Rohrbach complaining that her story on Epstein had been 86'd by top brass at ABC. And she kind of complained that, yes, she 100% believes Epstein was killed, not that he killed himself. So it just took off on Twitter with and Instagram with Joe Rogan and these other big boosters of the meme. And what I found interesting about it is it started appearing in real life at sporting events along the freeways of Los Angeles. I found it in a way it was like people say this and it's a joke. But there is a kind of serious point to a lot of jokes, and one of them is, the statement behind Epstein didn't kill himself is, one, I believe our elites and our institutions are capable of any corruption and depravity, right? It can be just a general purpose statement of that, and it's almost like practicing saying it. And one of the responses I got from writing this little column talking about this practice of saying this in a jokey way was from people who lived in Poland under during the Cold War, saying that this is how people in the Eastern Bloc kind of got through the political turmoil of the 70s and early 80s was with this kind of dark humor about how corrupt and venal and evil their rulers were. And I just think it's kind of interesting that this is popping up in America in 2019.
Liz, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, two things can be true at once, that the method of his death was suicide and that there was some participation of wealthy people who had something to gain from his death, or more to the point, something to lose from his living, participating in that somehow, right? The whole thing does look kind of fixed in the sense that, he tried to commit suicide once and was stopped and then succeeded despite being put on suicide watch. And we've all been through the sort of irregularities around his death. There does seem to be something fishy about it. I think that's why people are so fixated on it. Is it possible it was 100% simple, straightforward, just a suicide with bad prison setup and poor security and surveillance? Yeah, that's possible. Is the other alternative possible as well? Yeah, also possible. And I think that what it drives home is that, as Michael said, our elites are perverse, corrupt, and preying on us, us being ordinary people. And I think that is very obvious at this point. And the Epstein affair happening during the Trump era just drives it all home in a really convenient way. If anything, this is a great unifier in that people on the left and the right seem to agree there is something very, very disturbing about how all this went down.
And so what do you do about that? If your diagnosis is basically that our elites are so corrupt that they cannot be trusted even on something like this, where it seems, to my mind, to be clearly true, how the evidence points to what happened here, that they, you know, they so demonstrated their corruption through Epstein, you know, being tolerated and even, you know, feted for so long, and then other things that we've seen with, you know, the open secrets around Harvey Weinstein and the efforts by media organizations to suppress reports about Harvey Weinstein's terrible behavior, that sort of thing. What do you do about any of that? I mean, I think, you know, Michael, the president frames himself as a reaction to this sort of elite depravity, but the president is a personification of it, and including many of the specific aspects. I mean, not of the specific Epstein behavior, but of, you know, the president, you know, is a sexual predator, or at least there's good reason to believe that he is one, given all the accusations that have been made against him by women who say that they have been groped and such. The president certainly looks like he's committing a wide variety of financial corruption. So, you know, why would that be the channel for responding to this, and what more productive channel could there be?
I don't know that, you know, the election of Donald Trump really was a firm, you know, attempt at any kind of anti-corruption. I think Republicans simply believe that Hillary Clinton was corrupt in some fundamental way. I agree with that. I think many of them would acknowledge that Donald Trump is corrupt in some fundamental way. That's why he was the least popular major party presidential nominee in history. So that is not I don't think Trump can be said to be a response to this lack of faith in institutions. As for a more productive response, of course, would be to heroically venture out and begin repairing our institutions, whether they're Congress, you know, a different class of people entering politics and putting different rules in place in Congress, putting different expectations of presidents in place. That is what people need to do to respond to this feeling of corruption. But in the meantime, there is a kind of, I do think there is a kind of solace in joking about this and joking about it openly, right? I do think that is a kind of, you know, even a first step is to acknowledge the problem, right? And just saying Epstein didn't kill himself is kind of like a funny way of saying, you know, yes, we live in a world where things are upside down.
Liz, what do you say is a way out?
Well, I can think of a few. A lot of the politics that you see right now that aim to kind of depose the elite class by proposing wealth taxes, for example, or higher taxes on the rich in general, are a response in large part to these kinds of events. And I think they make a lot of sense. I think that inequality fosters a lot of problems, you know, the straightforwardly economic and financial. It also fosters a lot of sort of problems that can only be described as sort of spiritual or moral problems. And I think that the sort of depravity of the elite class and the degree to which they get away with it repeatedly is part of that moral problem of inequality. And I think that trying to reduce inequality, therefore, isn't just a material issue. It's also a moral issue.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Michael Brendan Doherty, it's your soapbox.
So I want to complain about hypersensitivity to allergies as parents in a tonier school district in the country. We somehow have this obligation to bring in cupcakes for my daughter's entire class. We go out, we buy certified peanut-free cupcakes, bring them to her school this morning, and they were rejected because they were not labeled tree nut free as well. So the only place to buy tree nut free cupcakes is Whole Foods a few towns over. I had to rush there. So I'm mad at the snowflakes and the hypersensitivity that leads to this kind of panic about cupcakes.
Liz Brunig, what's on your mind?
Young adult fiction Twitter is well known as one of the crazier parts of Twitter. This week exemplified that. A famous young adult fiction author, Sarah Dessen, located a small South Dakota newspaper quoting a graduate student who said that when she was a college student at a tiny South Dakota college, she had joined a committee on the college's core reading list to keep young adult fiction books like Dessen's off of it and make sure the college kids were reading stuff at their reading level. She suggested the book Just Mercy instead, which is about race and incarceration. This infuriated Dessen, who took to Twitter to sic her over 200,000 Twitter followers on this small paper and the graduate student who made the comments. This is ridiculous. It is insane. It is an abuse of power. And young adult fiction Twitter and young adult fiction in general needs to get over the fact that they're not writing literary fiction and accept that they're doing a good thing by providing kids to read. But that's what it is. It's stuff for kids.
For my rant, she doesn't know who the fuck she's tweeting. That's what billionaire hedge fund manager Leon Cooperman said to a CNBC reporter. He was outraged because Elizabeth Warren had an ad attacking him, saying he'd been charged with insider trading by the SEC, which incidentally is true. Elizabeth Warren has been really enjoying the fight she's been getting to have with Wall Street billionaires, and why shouldn't she? They get so personally wounded over her wealth tax proposal. I'm not in favor of the wealth tax proposal. We've discussed on this show previously what I see as certain operational problems with it. I think it is plausible that at the high rates she is proposing, it would have real and significant negative economic consequences. But the hurt feelings of billionaires is not a good reason to oppose the wealth tax. And yet it seems to be the one those billionaires focus on and insist on airing in public to Elizabeth Warren's great political advantage. So if they want to avoid her election and they want to avoid the imposition of a wealth tax, my advice to them is they should be quiet. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Michael Brennan Doherty, Liz Brunig, and Merve Teheralu. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.